Welcome to WISO Weekend, WISO's weekly radio magazine. I'm Jerry Kenny. Thanks for joining us this Sunday morning. Coming up on today's program, Community Voices producer Jason Reynolds brings us Culture Couch, and Bill Felker has this week's Poor Will's Almanac. Later in the program, we'll talk with Montgomery County Commissioner Debbie Lieberman and County Administrator Michael Colbert about the future state of the Montgomery County Jail. Up first, school is back in session in many Dayton area school districts. Hundreds of students in those districts were in some way affected by both the Memorial Day tornadoes and the Oregon District mass shooting. Some of those districts say they are responding to students' mental health needs, but the need for the services they're providing has been rising in recent years. In the Charlotte Madison City School District, 226 students were displaced by the May tornadoes. Officials say they're seeing students with signs of trauma related to the tornado and the shooting. The district's Ella Jordan Isaac says so far they've identified five students that have exhibited or come forward to express post-tornado trauma.
Mental health therapists, we have social workers, and our counselors are all being very vigilant in terms of keeping an eye out for student behavior, concerns from families, and as it stands, we know that our families are very clear using the parent engagement system that if there are concerns or supports or resources that they need, that we have a network in place.
In the Beaver Creek City School District, officials report they're also seeing more students who need mental health assistance. Bobby Fiore is director of student services. She says those cases are in addition to an existing upward trend in the district for more emotional support services.
You know, not every kid's coming to school knowing how to take somebody else's perspective or be able to build and maintain relationships with other kids or be able to wait their turn and follow directions. And some of that leads to behavior problems and conflict among peers. So we've been seeing the need to address more social emotional topics and skills over the past 3 or 4 years.
The same trends are visible in Dayton Public Schools, officials say. Because of the increased need for student support services, DPS Superintendent Elizabeth Lally says the district is working on a plan to increase the number of counselors available for struggling students.
We are probably about 6 to 8 months away from rolling that fully out. But we are very aware with the governor's new initiative, Dayton Public Schools, as well as many other schools in this state, will have some additional funding to support some additional personnel, and that's what we're planning right now.
In August, Governor Mike DeWine announced the new state budget included $675 million in funding for schools working with local mental health and social service providers to address social and emotional support services for students. And Dayton-themed tattoos have become popular across the city since the mass shooting in the Oregon District last month. People are getting Gem City and Dayton Strong designs. Tattoo fundraisers have become popular, too. More than 100 people got tattooed at an event called Drawing Dayton Together. And another fundraiser for the Love of Dayton is coming up this afternoon. Community Voices producer Jason Reynolds says artists and customers are using the ink to help their community heal.
Six people are getting tattooed simultaneously at the Yellow Cab Tavern in Dayton's Oregon District. The Yellow Cab usually isn't the place to get a tattoo, but this is a fundraiser for the Dayton Foundation in the wake of a mass shooting that killed 9 and injured dozens. Dayton-themed tattoos are just $50, but the artists aren't keeping any money. It all goes to charity. Outside, there are live bands, fire dancers, and food trucks. But inside, 8 hours after the event started, they're still drawing, over 100 tattoos later. Tyler Mackey and his friends are getting ink that goes together.
I'm getting Orville Wright, and my buddy's getting Wilbur Wright, and then my other buddy is getting the third Wright brother, who is an accountant. I think his name is Lauren Wright. Yeah.
Mackey is wowed by what these artists are doing for the city.
It was easy on my part, you know, I just had to stand in line, but these guys have been tattooing for 8 hours straight, and it's amazing to watch.
Will Eagle is one of the artists. He's about to do his 16th tattoo of the day.
I've done a lot of Ohio outlines with Dayton in it. I did this really cool Gem City tattoo. It was a lot of fun. I've done a lot of paper airplanes, all sorts of cool stuff.
Eagle says events like this play an important role in how the tattoo community works.
In the past has been animosity between shops. There used to be rivalries, all this stuff. And what we're showing here is that we've evolved. We've come further than that. We're bringing everybody together. It doesn't matter where you work or who you are. We're here for the community.
And Daytonians seem eager to use tattoos as a sign of unity after a summer that saw a mass shooting, a KKK rally, and multiple tornadoes. James Surcue was in line for a tattoo at 3 p.m. At 11, he's finally getting his ink. The shape of a gem with the Gem City skyline inside of it.
I've been Dayton strong my whole life, and I think it's just, it's so heartbreaking. You never think that it's going to be your community. This is a powerful moment in Dayton for everybody to stand up, and I'm trying to be a part wherever I can.
Lacey Terrell is one of the organizers of this event. She says it's about more than tragedy.
I feel like it's also having pride for being from Dayton. What once was a sad city is now coming together and becoming so strong. And then who doesn't want their city's name tattooed on them? I have pride. I'm proud to say that I'm from Dayton.
A few days later, and a few blocks away, Sherry Hignite and Shannon House meet up at the sidewalk bar at Toxic Brew Company. They're setting up Dayton's next tattoo fundraiser. It's called For the Love of Dayton, and tattoo artists are coming in from around the globe. But tattooers are just one aspect of the event. There will also be bands, comedians, blackjack tables, face painting for kids, vendors, and piercers. House says this will be an emotional event for her, with a friend who was injured in the shooting wanting to get new ink, if the doctors will let her.
Nicole is her name. She was here, suffered a gunshot wound to the head. She has since been released from the hospital, but did contact me from the hospital and said, hey, you know, I would really love to come get tattooed at the event if possible. You know, that's what we're here for. We want our city healthy again.
The outdoor seating at Toxic Brew Company is just steps from where the shooter opened fire. Toxic's warehouse and distribution manager, Adam Stevens, says Toxic will be donating beer and manpower to the event. He was at Toxic the night of the shooting.
I was actually more or less where we're standing right now. I heard a couple of pops. It was just the weirdest thing. I mean, I've heard so many other people say it. It sounded like firecrackers. And then I saw everybody running and came back in through this side door that we're standing here now and saw the everybody piled into the back. And it was one of those things that was over so quick, I didn't even realize what was going on until the aftermath walking through. So kind of trying to process all that, all the images and everything was rough.
On Stephen's forearm, there's some fresh ink. The outline of the map of Ohio with a gem where Dayton lies. Stephen says he got his tattoo at an event at White Anvil Tattoo. The shop was giving that tattoo to anyone who wanted it, free of charge, and a lot of people started showing up.
Sounds like at least a couple hundred less Daytonians are walking around with them now. So.
And after this weekend, there will be even more Dayton Strong ink in a city that wears its heart on its tattoo sleeves. For Culture Couch at WYSO, I'm Jason Reynolds.
For the Love of Dayton tattoo event takes place today from noon to midnight at the Antioch Shrine in downtown Dayton. For more information, you can visit our website, wyso.org. Culture Couch is made possible by a generous grant from the Ohio Arts Council. I'm Jerry Kenney. This is WYSO Weekend. Every Tuesday, clients at United Rehabilitation Services of Greater Dayton gather together and prepare for an excursion in sound. On this day, they're heading out to the jungles of Africa.
Strap on your seatbelt and enjoy the African safari.
URS offers programs meant to enhance the physical, social, and emotional needs of children, adults, and seniors with developmental or acquired disabilities. The adults participating in today's drum circle offer a glimpse into the variety of clients the organization serves. Several who have been given instruments to play are getting help from their neighbors in the circle. Randy holds a baton while his neighbor holds the drum for him.
So, Randy has something a little different. He has a drum pad. So let's hear. It kind of sounds like someone's knocking at the door, right?
Yeah.
Yep, so do it again.
Smiles light their faces as the drumming exercise continues.
It's very therapeutic. The clients are learning a sense of purpose. It alleviates tension. It helps our clients to relax, to experience music in a different way.
Vivian O'Connell is the development director for URS.
The program is through Health Rhythms in Cincinnati. It was developed by a neurologist named Dr. Barry Bittman. And we've had three staff actually trained in this program. We're also doing intergenerational activities with the preschoolers and some of our seniors in our center. So it's a really innovative program that no one else locally is offering to kids and adults with disabilities.
Back in the drum circle, Brandy Battle continues to guide the clients through the Healthy Rhythms exercise. The program Dr. Bittman has developed stems from the philosophy that within a healthcare organization's relationship, relationship with its clients. Nothing is more powerful than the patient experience. Battle says her clients feel that power.
They love it. They get so excited. They ask me about it every day. They know that the class is on Tuesdays, but every day they'll stop me. Are you going to have the class on Tuesday? Yes, I am. So they look forward to it.
You had 2 days of training, I believe, in Cincinnati.
Yes.
And tell us what it was like to go through this training with other organizations like yours.
It was awesome. It was great meeting other people and getting their ideas on how they would facilitate their training and you know, their agencies. It was good being with other adults that like to play the drums. And then when we did like the guided imagery piece, we were pretending that we were in a rainforest and then having all the musical instruments. And then some of the people would come in, they would sing and act like they were like in a tribe in the jungle. And it was just so exciting to have that type of training with all those people.
Tell us about the 10-step protocol.
So the first step is introducing the program. You sit with the individuals, tell them the benefits of the program, what they'll be doing today. The wellness piece, which is steps 2 and 9, where we closed our eyes and imagined that we were in a rainforest or at the zoo. Step 3 is called breaking the ice, where we use the little lemon shakers. Let's see, step 4, the ABCs of drumming. That's where they go around and they play their drum. You can get the different sounds of the drums. Rhythmic naming is where you play your name on the drum, or it could be the name of your favorite movie. So the entrainment building, that's where the person who leads the drum, they'll play a beat, and then they'll switch it up and then see if everyone can catch the rhythm. So inspirational beats is where we did something that inspired us. Today we talked about our favorite drink. Last week it was our favorite ice cream, so you can switch it up. And then the finale, step 10, that's where you go around and you ask, how do you feel? Do you feel happy? How did it help your mood? So
the Healthy Rhythms program at URS is supported by grants from the Dayton Foundation and other local funding. Vivian O'Connell says URS is always looking for ways to bring in new programming.
This year we funded an art enrichment program that involves performing, visual, and all the different arts. We're bringing in the Muse Machine, Dayton Performing Arts Alliance. We're working through Art Connect. We have music therapy through University of Dayton, so we're trying to bring more opportunities to the center for the clients that we serve. On a daily basis, we'll have 300 to 400 kids and adults that we're serving in our center, and we're, you know, always looking for new opportunities to provide engaging programming for them.
If the philosophy that the Healthy Rhythms program operates under, that nothing for a healthcare organization is more powerful than the patient experience, then the program is a success, according to URS clients like Tom and Tina.
I really like it.
You're going to come back and bang some more drums next week?
Yes.
And how did you like the drum circle?
I just like the drum circles. I might do it again next Tuesday.
Yeah, that's great. You couldn't wait to bang the drum, right?
Right. I can't wait.
For WISO Weekend on WYSO, I'm Jerry Kenney. Montgomery County is launching plans to renovate the county jail. Officials say the renovations will help improve a number of poor structural and inmate conditions that have been linked to a string of lawsuits alleging prisoner mistreatment. To get the details, we spoke with County Commissioner Debbie Lieberman and County Administrator Michael Colbert. We start with a discussion about what all of this has cost the county.
I'm going to let Michael speak to the money part, but we're now at $13 million for settlements and over issues that happened at the jail. And so, you know, when we asked this Justice Committee to look at it, it was out of concern for what was happening. And a big portion of that concern is the layout of the jail, how it flows. Part of the jail is very old. Part of it's 30 years old, 30 years plus. And so, you know, we knew it wasn't all just personnel. So I'm going to turn it over to Michael now.
Yeah, part of, as the commissioner mentioned, is we need to bring the jail up for standards. So what we're doing is HDR is going to create a new jail master plan, which also takes in consideration the census, how many people we have in the jail, the flow, as the commissioner mentioned, the inside programmatic component, which is whether or not we have the appropriate health care or the appropriate mental health services or the appropriate drug addicted services. It takes in consideration community feedback. So we need to get feedback from the community, which the commissioner's already started with the Justice Committee. But a big part of this is kind of unrelated to the cases. The real issue here is we want to have a high quality and a up-to-date standard-wise jail. I mean, that's the big thing. First of all, most of the people that go into jail haven't been convicted of anything. So while they're in there, we want to treat them for whatever brought them there at the point of entry. And then also, we need to make sure that the jail is not overcrowded and that we have the appropriate services inside the jail to help you.
You know, and Michael mentioned the safety. It's safety for our corrections officers and the sheriff's staff, and it's also safety for those people that, the inmates that are there. We're already doing some work right now on the first floor when people come in. And as the sheriff will tell you, you know, there's a very large percentage of people that are in there with drug addiction and mental health illness. We're going to have to treat it all differently than we have in the past. And right now, the jail just isn't equipped for a lot of the issues that the sheriff's office sees every single day. So we're looking forward to working with HDR, having them create this needs assessment and a master plan that then we can decide, okay, now what are the next steps? How much of a new jail do we need to build? You know, can we add on to what we have, which, you know, as laymen, we think we all can. We think that it's something that, you know, what the bones that are there now, we can add on to that. So we'll see what happens. I mean, we don't have a definitive answer, you know, because people do say, are you building a new jail? Well, that would be our last choice if we had to. But I think that I know there are ways that we can take what we have. But we're going to hold off and listen to what the experts say on this.
Okay, and you mentioned the Justice Advisory Committee formed in 2017, and I believe they submitted some 90 recommendations earlier this year. And so can you talk a little bit about the process of weighing through that, or is that what is going into the next steps?
That is what's going into the next steps. So we've actually already internally weighed through all the recommendations, one of it which is enhancement of the existing facility. We know the two pods that we have on 2nd Street are good pods, and we can use that space for inmate housing. The older jail that was built in the 1960s, we want to get inmates out of that section. So when the commissioner was talking about the possibility of a jail enhancement, it is our goal, since now under new regulations, individuals cannot be bunked in bunk bed style bunking. They have to be what's called debunked. Everybody has to be flat. When we add to that, we believe that we can add another component to the existing structure that was built in the 90s and keep our cost to the taxpayers down as much as we can. But to your point, this is going to be a multi-million dollar enhancement of the jail.
So when you talk about hiring CGL or HDR plus the lawsuits, what's the assessment on Montgomery County budgets and how this has stretched and how will the county make up for this in the long run if they can?
What we will end up doing is HDR will end up giving us a estimate based on the master plan. And the master plan will be based on the average census. So right now we're looking at an average census of 700 to 850 inmates per day. We will look at our existing infrastructure and what we need to add on. Construction for jail right now is around $140,000 per inmate. So in a total cost figure to add 700 beds, if you will, we're looking at an estimate somewhere south of $90 to $100 million. That would be a total project cost. So with that kind of project cost, we would be looking at support from state and from the federal government to ease the burden locally. What we would then do is look at issuing what's called a general obligation bond, and that would be our financing, and we would back that by the full faith of Montgomery County, and we would finance that over a series of years.
And I just want to add to that, right now throughout the state, many counties are looking at building new jails. Franklin County just built a new jail. I don't even know if they've moved into it yet. They haven't. But so this is something that
counties
throughout the state are talking about, and governor's office and our legislature is fully aware of it. And so we're hopeful, and I say that seriously, hopeful that some capital dollars will be earmarked for jails for counties. And so, you know, I serve on the County Commissioner Association Board, and it's something that we talk about almost every month. And, you know, we have to have safe jails. I mean, it's just the bottom line, and we hate that, you know, to have to continue to build more jails, but counties are busting at the seams. You know, when you look at throughout the state, our jail is probably better than most, and that's sad but true, but it's something, it's not just happening here in our county. It's really happening all over the state. The other thing that's happening is, you know, the state has said you counties can keep your F4 and F5 felons. So we're doing that. We're doing our part so that they don't have to build more prisons. And so far with this new administration, we've had a great partnership. I know we're only half a year into it, but we have a great partnership. And the governor and his team really get what counties do and why we're so important. So this is just one area, but it's such an important area as well.
You mentioned that some of these problems are logistical with the layout of the building and the age, but some of them were staff-related. I imagine some of the 90 recommendations had to do not with the facility, but with how the police operate within their structure. And so can you kind of assess for us how that element of the whole picture has gone and what may take place?
Yes. And so we do have a new sheriff. Rob Struck is our sheriff, and we've been working with him since the beginning of the year. We've had a great working relationship. You don't want to blame the sheriff on what has happened over the years, but one of the things, sadly, that did happen was when the recession took place in 2008, every office in the county had to cut, including the sheriff, including his corrections officers. And so, you know, a lot of overtime has happened over the years. And so this year we added 10 full-time corrections officers. And so that was one of the recommendations, is that the sheriff, the jail, needs more officers there. And we don't disagree with that at all. So that is something that he's working on. He's been having a lot of job fairs and really pushing out there that he wants to hire more people. So I think that was part of all the issue. And then another is it was just unfortunate. I mean, I don't know what more to say. Every one of these that you look at, that either the ones we've settled on or the ones that are still pending, were just really unfortunate situations. And not all of them really were the deputies' faults. I will say that. So we just don't want anything like that to happen anymore. It hasn't. That's what's been great. We really haven't had any issues over there in quite a while. And so hopefully, and I'm confident with all these things working together, you know, we could be the best run jail in the state.
Another big part is the jail census has changed. So when you look at the overall population, we used to have less women in the jail. Now we have more women. We didn't have people that were so heavily dependent on drugs or alcohol or opiates. That was a wave that hit us. And now we're dealing with a methamphetamine wave, so we have another wave that's coming at us, which is why we have to change the standard. We have to make sure that we're able to treat people for the time that they are in the jail, so that when we release them back into the public, they've had some form of mental health or physical health or some type of opiate-addicted treatment. And that total population is way different than when we built the jail 30 years ago.
Well, you mentioned going forward, Commissioner Lieberman, that hopefully all this will work itself out. There are a lot of people paying attention to this problem and actually working directly on it. And I think you've got Montgomery County residents that would like to see this go away and a better day ahead for Montgomery County.
Exactly. You know, it's one of those things, you know, it just is like, when is this going to end? And you can't work in an environment like they do and not have the facilities that are safe. And, you know, we heard from some deputies that, especially in the older part of the jail, they had total blind corners. I mean, so they didn't know as they're going around a corner what was around there. So this is something that Yes, the whole community would like to see fixed. I know we do, and it's going to happen. In our county, criminal justice takes about 73% of our general fund, and that's just a given. You know, I've been a commissioner for 15 years, and that number varies maybe by 1% or 2%, but that's what it is. And that includes the jail, and it includes the sheriff, and it also includes common police courts and anything that has to do with criminal justice. But we want to make sure that our employees and the population are safe.
Thank you both for your time and the information that you've provided us today, and we'd love to talk again as things move forward.
Okay, great. Thanks, Jerry.
Thank you, Jerry.
This is Bill Felker with Poor Will's Almanac for the second week of early fall, the fourth week of the autumn apple-picking moon, and the final week of the sun in Virgo, the transition week of the sun to Libra. The time of early fall is an ambivalent time for me, a time of being on the edge. Summer isn't really gone, but the foliage is aging quickly and flowers are disappearing. The days may be warm and even humid, but the sun is a March or maybe even an early April sun, and it could rise to frost on any morning. I do experience a vague excitement now, and I'm in suspense as to just when the wind will change. I look forward to the cold, feel relief at the end of the dog days, but I also wish that the season did not have to change so quickly. And I enjoy being between two very distinct spaces in the shifting of the earth, in a brief respite from clarity. I enjoy feeling disconnected and suspended in solitude. This is a kind of twilight sanctuary, like luxurious waiting, half asleep for daybreak, all serious decisions on hold, all choices still possible. Dreams gone, but their imprint still set in my brain like the impressions of a wrinkled pillowcase on my cheek. In September, I walk back to those places from which color and fragrance have faded, but which have left marks of transition and renewal. I walk into the nostalgic dusk between endings and beginnings to an interim of faith in which I withhold commitment and certainty and taste a momentary delicious suspension of disbelief. This is Bill Felker with Poor Will's Almanac. I'll be back again next week with notes for the third week of early fall. In the meantime, bask in the twilight between seasons. Suspend your progress towards winter. In other words, procrastinate.
Bill Felker contributes to newspapers nationwide, including the Yellow Springs News. Bill resides in Yellow Springs. Poor Will's Almanac is also available as a podcast at WYSO.org.
That's it for this edition of WYSO Weekend on 91.3 WYSO, building a more informed community with independent news and storytelling. I'm Jerry Kenney. We'll be back next Sunday morning at 10. Thanks so much for joining us. Coming up next on WYSO, it's Vic McCunis with the Book Nook.